Hi, this is Neil Denny, and I've just got a quick announcement to make before we start this week's show. As I'm sure you've heard me mention already, I'm off to America for a month on the 12th of May, thanks to a generous travelling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. I'm going to record a load of interviews with scientists and other science types, and I've decided to release these as a separate series of podcasts. I've created a new RSS feed ahead of time, so you can subscribe to it before I go away. It's called Little Atoms Road Trip. It should be on iTunes any day now, but otherwise you can find the link on the Little Atoms website, littleatoms.com. Going forward, I want to add some consistency to when the podcasts go online, so this means that the Little Atoms podcast will be published every Monday, and the Little Atoms Road Trip podcast every Friday, and the first one of these will be published on Friday the 18th of May. Finally, and last but not least, I want to say a massive thank you to everyone who responded to the recent appeal on the website for donations. I managed to raise the target I was looking for, and it's all been spent on shiny new recording equipment, which with any luck will translate into a more consistent sound quality for the show. The equipment's going to get a thorough road testing on the American trip, so you'll be able to judge the results. Anyway, that's enough from me. Let's get on with the show. Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and it's great to welcome back Jonah Lira to the show. Jonah Lira is a contributing editor at Wired and a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. He writes the Headcase column for The Wall Street Journal and regularly appears on WNYC's Radiolab. His writing has also appeared in Nature, The New York Times Magazine and Scientific American. Jonah graduated from Columbia University and attended Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. The author of two previous books, Proust Was a Neuroscientist and The Decisive Moment. His latest is Imagine How Creativity Works. So, Jonah, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thank you so much for having me back on the show.
Creativity, that's like, it's quite a nebulous concept. Why did you want to tackle that?
Well, I was drawn to the nebulousness, I was drawn to the vagueness of the mystery. You know, here's a defining feature of human nature and we know so little about it. And that's kind of, in general, my methodology. I'm drawn to questions that are so vague and so hard to even ask that one doesn't even know where to begin. And those are the kinds of things which, number one, I could imagine spending 3 or 4 years of my life thinking about. And number two, allows me to tell a range of different stories. I love finding the stories, I love reporting the stories, and I love trying to write the stories so that they at least come alive a little bit. And with these vague subjects like decision-making or creativity, you can tell lots of different stories, and that's the fun part.
I guess a central theme of the book is this idea that there isn't a creative type, the myth. There is a myth that there are people that are uniquely talented as far as creativity is concerned. So you're sort of trying to dispel that myth.
Yeah, there are two myths I think I wanted to dispel. One is that there is such a thing as a creative type, and the second myth is that those creative types think in a certain way, and that's what makes them different from you and I. And both these things are not true. Creativity is a universal human talent. It doesn't mean it's evenly distributed talent, like every other talent. Mm-hmm. Some people have more of it than others. But it does mean we can all learn to become more creative, and that's really what the book is about. One of the reasons, I really wanted to write this book was you see these very sad surveys of school kids in America where you ask a second grader, so a 7-year-old, are you creative? And 95% say, yes, I love to paint, I love to draw, I love to sculpt, I'm a creative person. You ask a 10-year-old that question, 10, 11, 12-year-old, so someone in fifth grade, say, are you creative? And now you're down to about 50%. So it's already fallen dramatically in just 3-4 years. You ask a high school senior, so a 17-year-old, are you creative? And 95%, between 90 and 95% say, no, I'm not the creative type. So somewhere over the course of schooling, we convince the vast, vast majority of kids they are not creative, that they are not the creative type. And that struck me as so sad.
So is that just because there are, people are, I guess, send down certain channels to do with other talents. So, if you're going to be, you have a bend towards maths and science, therefore we're going to train you towards that, but then not necessarily towards art and creativity.
But that also involves creativity,
sure,
right?
Sure, of course.
I think because we so segmentize it, I think the more complicated part of the story is that this drop-off in just kind of free-flowing creativity, spontaneous creativity, is also a testament to the development of the brain. Mm-hmm. So, it's about, educators call it in America, the fourth grade slump, where it's about when they're 8, 9, 10, where kids all of a sudden lose interest in just painting for fun, drawing for fun, writing short stories for fun. And that's often tied, typically tied to just the fact that it's when our frontal lobes come online. And the frontal lobes, you know, they're a pretty crucial brain area. They're that voice, you know, they allow us to exert self-control, mm-hmm. that voice telling us to say no, so they allow you to raise your hand and not eat all the ice cream in the freezer and so on. But when it comes to creativity, they also get in the way because, you know, they tell you not to draw that line, that line is in the wrong place and not to play that note because that's the wrong note and this won't be beautiful or pretty enough. You're worried about the expectations of others. Mm-hmm. And all those thoughts, many of which are so essential for everyday life, they actually hinder our spontaneous creativity. So part of it is just the normal course of brain mm-hmm. development. There's a great Picasso line about every child's born an artist, the problems begin when we grow up. And then there's some neurological truth to that. But I think the larger problem, the more important problem, is that our schools are just very efficient at killing creativity off. That we encourage this very narrow version of what good thinking looks like, which is to be focused, to be attentive, to be quiet, to not be impulsive. And many times those are essential, right? One often wants to be focused and not impulsive. But it turns out with creativity that the most productive ways to think are actually a little more complicated. Sometimes you want to daydream. People who daydream more score much higher on tests of creativity. That attention deficit disorders. In America, we diagnose up to 20% of kids mm-hmm. in some classrooms with attention deficit disorders. But people with ADD are actually more likely to be eminent creative achievers. Sometimes being distractible is a perk because it means you combine ideas in unexpected ways. So I think we should, instead of teaching our kids not to daydream, to drilling that out of them in second grade very early on, to teach them instead, you know, here's how to productively daydream and so on.
We'll come back to the attention deficit disorder in a while, I think. But let's take a step back and look at how long have people been researching? When did people first start to investigate creativity and imagination as a sort of scientific? There's a fantastic quote from David Hume that you use, for instance, which is, you know, this idea that invention is often an act of recombination of sort of existing ideas. So people have obviously been thinking about this for a long time.
No, and it's interesting. You're back to like Aristotle, he writes a lot about the imagination. And there's some debate amongst, you know, Aristotelian scholars just how seriously he took the muses, whether or not he was actually using them metaphorically and kind of realized that they don't exist, that there are no fickle gods up in the sky actually breathing on you. And I think most assume he's not being entirely literal about it. But when you read his writing, it's still pretty, I think, clear that he doesn't know where to place it. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to be one of these human gifts that is neither fully within us nor fully outside of us. That he knows, in the end, it's an individual responsible for these new ideas. It comes from somewhere within us. And yet it does seem so mysterious that, especially when we have a moment of insight, we can't explain where the idea comes from. We can't trace back the etymology of those thoughts. Mm-hmm. They seem to emerge out of nowhere. And they arrive when we least expect them. People have been thinking about, you know, where their ideas come from as long as they've had ideas to ponder. In terms of when science, I think, became interested in something, I think Hume has some of the best passages on creativity mm-hmm. you're ever going to find. And Hume's in particular, his critique is of this notion that we just invent ideas out of thin air. He said that's actually rubbish. That when you actually look at creative breakthroughs, that they're really just taking old ideas and moving them to new domains or finding a new connection between old ideas. And even some of the most radical breakthroughs that are out there are really just a new combination of pre-existing things. And I think there's a lot of truth to this. You can look at the Gutenberg printing presses, mm-hmm. you know, wine press technology applied to the printed word. You know, the Google search algorithm is a method used to rank academic articles. So more citations equal more influence, but you apply that to web links and so on. So I think Hume, as always, is a wise, wise man. In terms of when science, I think, first got interested in it, of course, yeah, I should clarify and say scientists have always been interested in it. I just don't think there's a whole lot that they found they could study. There weren't a lot of tractable questions. Mm-hmm. So there was a meta-analysis that came out in 2002, which showed that between 1950 and 2000, about 0.75%, so less than 1% of all psychology articles touched in any way, shape, or form on creativity. So this is not a widely studied phenomenon. And I do think neuroscience contributed to this. I think neuroscience helped make creativity more tractable because now all of a sudden you could use, you know, fMRI machines and EEG technologies, which are limited for sure, but which allow us to begin to understand the mechanics of exactly how the muses make it happen.
So let's look at some of that work that's going on now then. What advances have been made since we've been able to study people's brains on that sort of level?
Well, the first advance actually came, it was a advanced by cognitive psychologists who, the first question when you want to study, say, creativity in the lab is, how do you model it? You know, how do you generate lots of data? And particularly when you want to study something like a moment of insight, which epiphanies are few and far between. You can't just put undergraduates in a lab or on a brain scanner and say, have an epiphany. That'd be a very inefficient way to collect data. So what scientists had to come up with is a set of puzzles, various kinds of puzzles that can reliably generate moments of insight, the same phenomenology. And sure enough, the same brain areas light up inside these fMRI machines. So the first thing they discovered, and this is largely the work of Mark Beeman at Northwestern and John Kounios at Drexel, is that you put people in these fMRI machines and you give them, they're called compound remote associate problems. That's the methodology they use. The acronym has been unfortunate, CRAP. But it consists of three words like pine, crab, and sauce, and the subjects have to find the fourth word, which in this case is apple, that binds them all together, pineapple, crab, apple, applesauce. And so what you find, to make a long story short, is in the seconds before an insight appears, in the 2 to 3 seconds before it leaps into consciousness. So before people even are aware of it, it hasn't hit consciousness yet. This is the precursor. You see a sharp spike in activity in a part of the brain called the anterior superior temporal gyrus. Part of the brain nobody knows too much about. It's in the back of the right hemisphere, just behind your ear. It's been previously associated with things like the processing of jokes, lights up when you hear a punchline, also the interpretation of metaphors. And what it seems to be very good at is finding the distal connections between seemingly unrelated ideas. So you can look at, you know, a metaphor, for instance. Mm-hmm. Romeo saying that Juliet is the sun. Juliet and suns have literally nothing in common. Yet this one brain area is able to find the remote associations that bind them together. In the same way, pine, crab, and sauce, not words we use together very frequently. Yet this one brain area is able to find the one other word, apple, that actually they share in common. The argument is that when you need a moment of insight, a similar mental process has to unfold, because if the connections were obvious, if they were on the surface, you would have found them already. Mm-hmm. The reason you're so frustrated and stuck and stumped, the reason you need an epiphany, is because they're distal, is because they seem to be unconnected, is because the associations that bind them are very, very remote and subtle. And that's what this one brain area in the back of the right hemisphere seems to be especially good at.
So, I mean, you sort of raised the idea there, but we can, as so often in this field, and it's a reductionist look, but we can... Yeah. We can sort of narrow this down to a left brain and right brain thing.
Yeah.
Let's, on that level, talk about what the difference is between those two things.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly this old pop cliche about the left brain's the accountant,
literal-minded
and kind of annoying and pedantic, and the right hemisphere is the flighty, crazy artist. Those cliches mostly aren't true. And handedness gets complicated here, and the data on handedness is very confusing. Some people see a difference in handedness, and some people just don't in terms of how well you perform these various creative tasks. But it turns out our hemispheres do show different tendencies. They do have information processing dispositions. And to make a long story short, the differences you see are that the left hemisphere is more interested in the trees, in the granular details, in noticing the differences between things. Whereas the right hemisphere is more interested in the forest, in the gestalt, in seeing the connections between larger structures. And a lot of this work comes out of patients with severe neurological injuries, who often lose access to one of their hemispheres, thanks to a massive stroke or a big brain tumor, all sorts of tragedies. You know, what you find is that for a long time, people assume the right hemisphere is mostly useless because if you suffer damage to the right hemisphere, you seem pretty normal, right? You could still remember, you could still focus and function, you could still have most language faculties. And instead, people seem to suffer from very kind of minor deficits, like they couldn't understand jokes, they couldn't understand poetry or metaphors or similes. These complex, connotative aspects of language eluded them. But, you know, it's hard to complain too much about that when you've lost half your brain and you can still function. Whereas you suffer damage to the left hemisphere, and the damage is obvious, right? You often have severe language problems. You often have problems focusing. You often, you know, have aphasias in part of your sensory field, so you'll just ignore a whole part of the world. It's like very, very obvious, noticeable deficits. And that's why scientists really presumed that the left hemisphere was the important side, the right hemisphere was pretty useless. But I think it's become clear in recent decades, really since the early 1990s, that the right hemisphere is up to a lot, and that these deficits aren't quite as subtle as we long believed, and that actually many of the things which we take for granted when we rely on both hemispheres become really difficult for these right hemisphere patients. And a lot of their deficits do involve creativity, do involve creative aspects of cognition. So certainly the current cliche of the left hemisphere is the accountant, the right hemisphere is the artist, fast oversimplification. And I think there's lots of reasons why many scientists are eager to leave that behind. But the irony is that in recent years, there has been all this interesting evidence which suggests that there was a grain of truth to that too, that the right hemisphere does seem to be uniquely suited for certain kinds of creative tasks.
You mentioned a while ago the attention deficit people and how actually, you know, in some ways their creativity can be can be wider. In the last interview we did, we talked quite at length about dopamine and its its role in the decision-making process, and it comes up again in this book, and also the use of stimulants as well. You talk about, you know, coffee and alcohol and drugs. You talk about Auden being, you know, hooked on Benzedrine, basically. Yeah. And it's interesting that these things we would associate with, you would take these things, like, say, for instance, when you're cramming for an exam or something, to focus, something that, you know, a person wants to sort of focus at. But you contrast the idea between focusing on something and daydreaming and sort of conscious. So let's talk about those two aspects and how they relate to creativity.
Yeah, you know, there are these two general phases to the creative process. There's the inspiration phase, those moments of insight where we have these big new ideas, we restructure the problem. And then, of course, there's the good old-fashioned perspiration side of things, just grit, hard work. It's not fun. In fact, the evidence suggests it actually makes us a little miserable. But it's just as necessary. And when you talk to people in the creative business, they'll often begin by telling these very romantic stories about their epiphany in the shower. And then if you press them, they'll confess that, yeah, even after I had that big idea, I still needed to go through 100 edits. I still need to go through revision after revision, draft after draft, iteration after iteration. You still have to take these big new ideas and refine them for the real world. And so there are these, I think, two distinct phases, which I think helps reveal why there is no single way of being creative. That creativity is actually a bundle of distinct thought processes, each of which is well suited to different phases of the creative process. You know, so I think that's why sometimes you do want to daydream, because you're more likely when daydreaming to have these, you know, remote associations, to have these big ideas. But of course, then you're going to need to focus. You're going to need to drink a cup of coffee and stay late at the office and take Bennies and amphetamines. And, you know, there's a reason there's a Starbucks in every corner, because focus is very important. You know, in terms of ADD, I think one of the big misconceptions of ADD actually stems from its name, which is that we call it an attention deficit disorder, which is that people with ADD, they don't actually have an attention deficit disorder. They can play World of Warcraft for 12 hours straight. They have an attention allocation disorder. They often can't focus on boring stuff you know, very well. So if they're not interested in, they just want to look out the window instead. And what Ritalin and Adderall, the drugs that are commonly prescribed in the States for ADD, what they help people do is they make tedious stuff more interesting. Mm-hmm. They're mild amphetamines. They're like mild versions of Benzedrine. And for Auden, Benzedrine allowed him to really, for the first time, spend 12 hours in a single line of poetry. You know, he could just look at a poem and think about a single word for a long, long time in a way he really wasn't able to before. And so I think you see the payoff, for better or worse, in his poetry, that his poetry from his Benzedrine phase is leaner, it's spare, it's more transparent, it's more rhetorical. It's his most canonical stuff. It's the stuff that's in all the anthologies. It's not my favorite Auden poetry. I happen to love his late poetry, which is a little messier, a little more ambiguous, like In Praise of Limestone kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And Auden himself repudiated most of his Benzedrine poetry. Like September 1st, 1939 is nowhere in his own collected poems because he hated it. He thought he made it too simple. So, you know, it's a complicated story, but it's undoubtedly his most popular stuff. That is the stuff who most people, you know, when they associate poetry with Auden, it's these Benny poems. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that all that extra attention made them leaner and more transparent and cleaner and all the rest.
So what specifically then, with that amount of focus on something, are you in danger of losing out on?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a trade-off. So when you are focused, and you can give undergraduates amphetamines. People have done this work. You give them mild
That's
amphetamines.
That's slightly unethical.
Oh, well, they have to pass internal review board. Generally, you can do all sorts of mean tricks on undergrads. My favorite is actually this experiment I describe in the book, where to induce a sad mood, a low mood, and then to measure the cognitive benefits of low mood, they ask undergrads to recite their hopes and dreams. Then they have a confederate come in and tell them all the reasons their hopes and dreams will never happen. I'm like, how did that get through the review board? Fine, get them drunk, you know? Give them a pill. It'll wear off in 8 hours. Yeah. But to crush their hopes and dreams, like, God, vicious. I guess it's progress, you know. It's in the name of science, but it seems a little harsh. Like, what if they never recover from that? What if, like, you honestly crush their hopes and dreams? But so we were talking about the trade-off. So you can give undergrads amphetamines, and so they're very, very focused. And sure enough, they'll perform much better on things like long division, on algebra questions, on, you know, copy editing, things that require working memory and focus. Much, much better on. You know, that's why people take amphetamines in the first place, to focus on kind of the less interesting stuff. But you give them various creative tests, so tests that involve moments of insight, like compound mode associate problems, and their performance plummets. That because they're too focused, the noise of the world distracts them from the quiet voice in the back of their head trying to give them the answer. So there are constant trade-offs, and you see this again and again. that when you're happy, you're more likely to have a moment of insight, but it's harder for you to focus. When you're sad, it's easier for you to focus, but you're less likely to have a moment of insight. So the brain is this very finely equilibrated machine. And sure enough, you know, you boost one thing. This is why I'm so skeptical of cognitive enhancers or the one to be a pill that'll turn us all into, you know, Picasso, is that you boost one thing and you tend to create a deficit. That's just the way the mind is calibrated.
You're listening to Little Atoms, today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Jonah Lehrer about his book, Imagine How Creativity Works. So, Jonah, I want to move on now to look at the sort of different implications of sort of creativity between individuals, geniuses or whatever, or anybody, and the group. I want to look particularly at the experience of the 3M company. But it's interesting that only a couple of weeks ago, Susan Cain, the writer, was on the show talking about her book Quiet, and we talked in that about how there's been a debunking of the idea of brainstorming as a sort of aid to creativity. Yeah. So perhaps we should. What's your take on that? Perhaps we should talk about that first.
Oh, I think it's definitely been debunked, and the data is very clear. It goes back 60 years. You know, brainstorming was invented by Alex Osborne. He's kind of the Don Draper of his day, an ad executive. And in a series of best-selling books in the late 1940s, he lays out this technique called brainstorming. Very first rule of brainstorming, really the only rule that matters, is don't criticize, right? No criticism allowed. The imagination is very meek and shy. And if it's worried about being criticized, it'll just clam up and not be able to free associate at all. So that's why all ideas are good ideas in a brainstorming session. It's a lovely idea. It's a feel-good productivity technique. Just doesn't work. And the data is quite clear on this. Study after study has shown that people actually come up with fewer ideas when brainstorming and less original ideas than when they work by themselves. And so this backs up Susan Cain's hypothesis. I think where I diverge from Susan Cain, I think she kind of blames brainstorming because it's a group activity. I think it's just a bad group activity. The problem is in groups themselves. I think there's evidence that collaboration is becoming more important, that there are plenty of ways to turn us into more than some of our parts. It's just brainstorming, it's the wrong set of rules. And this is the work of Charlotte Namath at UC Berkeley primarily. And she's shown that the problem with brainstorming is that rule, don't criticize, because criticism is essential. Constructive criticism is great for creativity. So she has groups engaged in what she calls debate and dissent. And sure enough, they come up with 25 to 40% more ideas than those who brainstorm. Those ideas are also rated as more original. And that's because criticism draws us out. It wakes us up. It's invigorating. It means we've got some skin in the game. Mm-hmm. We're more attentive. We dig below the superficial surface of the imagination. And that's when things get interesting. And Namath also, as a control, has had people work on these problems by themselves. And debate and dissent groups outperform people working by themselves. So this is a technique that allows us to become more than the sum of our parts. The big caveat, of course, is that it's one thing to do these experiments with undergrads. They're one-off experiments. These people come together in a group once, criticize each other, and then they disappear. Mm-hmm. In the average workplace, people come together again and again. So I think what remains unclear is how to take this debate and dissent model and transition to the real world. What we know right now is that brainstorming doesn't work, that debate and dissent is better, but I don't think we've got a great model yet for really how to make debate and dissent an everyday technique for an office.
Well, I was going to say, let's talk about 3M, which is a great example of a company that actually more uses different people's different skills to focus on problems. But in terms of what we're talking about, actually, a better example is probably Brian Uzi's work on Broadway musicals, which you talk about in the book. So let's look at that. What's that experiment about and what happened there?
Yeah, you know, just to talk about 3M for a second. I find 3M to be a fascinating company simply because they're like the least sexy company in the world. They make post-it notes and scotch tape. And yet what people don't realize is they're incredibly innovative. They've got this track record of success. I think it's pretty unparalleled. 55,000 products, 55,000 employees, and so on. I think a lot of it has to do with the way they force people to mix and constantly interact, and it's a very horizontal place. But I do love this Brian Uzi experiment, simply because I love that someone spent this much time studying Broadway musicals.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he doesn't even like Broadway musicals. But he, you know, the reason he was interested in Broadway musicals is because they are this perfect template for artistic collaboration, right? Because no one makes a musical by themselves. You have a lyricist, a librettist, a choreographer, a director, taking notes from the producers, and so on. So it's a real group activity. And Uzi wanted to figure out, what's the ideal template for this kind of collaboration? Is it better to work with your best friends, people you've worked with before, what they call on Broadway repeat relationships? Or is it better to work with total strangers, to have all fresh voices in the room? Uzi's hypothesis was that intimacy was better. All things being equal, it was better to work with your best friends. So he created this metric called Q, you know, the letter Q, and he signed it to every musical produced on Broadway over the course of the 20th century. And this took a long time. He had to sift through dusty old playbills in the basements of Broadway theaters and so on. And what he discovered is that plays with a high Q, so a Q near 5, it's a scale on one, from 1 to 5, they didn't do well at the box office. In fact, they tended to bomb at the box office. Critics also didn't like them. Critics said, oh, it's more the same old, we've seen this already. Look at plays with a low Q, a Q near 1, where it's all strangers, they also didn't do well. And critics tended to say, like, oh, it's because it didn't hold together. Just different themes, jarring, didn't hold together, didn't work. So then Uzi found there was this very small sweet spot of Q, that plays produced with a Q between 2.2 and 2.7 were more than 3 times more likely to succeed at the box office and almost 4 times more likely to succeed with the critics. Which is, you know, a massive effect when you think about it. Just plays produced within this sweet spot were 3 times more likely to succeed. This is not a small finding, it's not a small effect size. And Uzi's favorite example, this is West Side Story, where you have 3 repeat relationships. You have Leonard Bernstein, Jerome Robbins, Arthur Lorenz, 3, you know, Broadway titans who have worked together before. But they realized they needed a fresh voice for the lyrics. So they went out and found this 25-year-old lyricist with absolutely no experience on Broadway. Their producers thought they were crazy, right? This was a big Broadway production. Why are they hiring someone to write the words who'd never done this before? But his name was Stephen Sondheim. This 25-year-old was named Stephen Sondheim. So, I mean, the first lesson of this is, one, if you can hire Stephen Sondheim, hire Stephen Sondheim.
That could be the key.
it's always good to have a genius on your team. But the larger lesson that Uzi tries to extract from it, at least, is that, you know, when in doubt, seek out that fresh voice. You know, seek out that voice who's going to disrupt you, who's going to introduce some tension into the room, because you don't want to be too comfortable. It'll always be easier to work with your best friends. But you want someone different.
And that's the key thing, that element of friction. Which is
you want the friction. Exactly. You want the debate, the dissent. You want the friction.
Okay, well, moving on, I want to look at, widening this idea of creativity as a group. You talk about cities and, you know, and the role that people living in big communities, city-wide communities, plays on, you know, how much that influences the amount of creativity in that city. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, cities are pretty amazing things. I've always lived in cities, but I never fully appreciated just how important they were. The guy I spent a lot of time with in the cities chapter is a theoretical physicist named Jeffrey West, who, you know, he calls cities the idea that has unleashed all of our ideas, the most important invention in the history of human civilization, and I think he's got a point. You know, cities are also, I think, urbanization is going to be the great theme of the 21st century. More people are going to move to cities in the next 100 years than have moved to cities in all of human history. Mm-hmm. By the end of the 21st century, the estimates by the UN are that upwards of 75% of the human population is going to live in these huge metropolises. And this is really because cities unleash innovation, that when you look at the productivity of people in cities, it's called superlinear scaling. That as cities get bigger, everyone in that city becomes more productive. They make more money, they invent more patents, invent more trademarks, by every metric we have. And you see this in country after country. Big cities make us even better. And this gets back to the magic of the city, which is that it smashes people together. It forces us to interact, to mix and mingle. It's about those random chats on the sidewalk while waiting in line for a latte. It's about those intersections in the subway. It's about those bumps, many of which are uncomfortable, right? It's like, that's why people move to the suburbs, right? Because they want to get away from this oppressive crush of people. And yet every once in a while, those bumps add up. They lead to a new idea. They create a knowledge spillover, and that leads to new knowledge. And that's the magic of a city. That's what cities do. That even in the 21st century, it's still the human friction of a city that makes the sparks. And this honestly was quite surprising to me, simply because I think it would be easy to look at all the technology we have, you know, email and Skype and video chats and FaceTime and these computers in our pockets, and think like, well, geography's dead. Right? Why pay the expensive rents to live in central London? Why commute? Why put up with the M4 or the tube? Why not just, you know, move to the middle of nowhere and telecommute from your couch in your pajamas while eating Fruit Loops? That'd be so much more convenient. And yet, you know, the more we have these tools that allow us to interact remotely, in a sense, the more important the cities become. And that, to me, is surprising, and I think remains a little bit mysterious. What exactly it is, because it is often described as an intangible. Something magic happens when people come together in person.
Well, I was going to move it on and describe, you know, the internet as being, you know, an even bigger city, a way for everybody to get together. But there's one great example that you talk about, which is Innocentive, this website of ideas. Like, what's that?
Innocentive is an interesting website, which is basically corporate problem solving. So it's a lot of Fortune 100 firms, General Electric, Procter & Gamble, Eli Lilly, big American firms, you know, some of the biggest firms in the world, who post their hardest problems online, problems that they think are impossible, that their own scientists say we can't solve. So keep in mind, these are companies with billions of dollars in their R&D budgets, and their hundreds of scientists or thousands of scientists can't solve them. And so they say, well, what do we get to lose? We may as well make them public. We may as well post our failures and because we can't solve them. And so what they do is they post their failures, post these impossible problems, and then put up a monetary reward. So if you can solve a G chemistry problem, maybe you'll make $1 million. Mm-hmm. If you can solve a problem for Kraft Foods, just last month I was looking at, they had an interesting problem. It was some kind of low-calorie chocolate-flavored compound coating. And, you know, if you can solve that, you can $50,000, and so on. And at first glance, you know, you'd probably look at that and say, like, well, what are the odds that someone's going to solve these problems, right? If a team of scientists at Kraft or GE or Procter & Gamble can't solve these problems, then why would some Joe Schmo sitting on his couch in his spare time, how could he solve them? You know, what's amazing about Innocentive is between 40 and 50% of all those problems are solved. Many of them are solved within a week of being posted. So they pay out rewards, sometimes multiple rewards. Now, when you look at, well, how is this possible? What explains the success? What you find is that Innocentive is really about the benefits of being an outsider. That when you look at who solves these problems, let's say GE posts a chemistry problem, that problem is almost never solved by another chemist. Instead, it's solved by someone on the fringe of that field, a molecular biologist, a biophysicist, a ordinary biologist, someone who knows enough to understand the terms of the question, but doesn't know so much they're into the exact same stumbling block as that chemist back at GE. So in a sense, they see more because they know a little bit less. This is counterintuitive, I think, simply because we live in an age where we kind of worship expertise, which is great. I love expertise just as much as the next person. But when it comes to creativity, that can also hold us back. The knowledge comes with blind spots. And you can also demonstrate this by looking at peak ages of creativity, which is Dean Simonton's work, which is in various fields. People tend to peak pretty early. So if you're a poet or you're a physicist, the evidence suggests you'll do your most creative work in your early 30s. And then followed by a long, slow decline. And for a long time, people thought that was inevitable, that it was about atrophy of the brain, that the imagination fell apart, like long-term memory. But now it's pretty clear that's a byproduct of enculturation, that people just become too experienced, that they become too invested in the status quo. They develop habits and routines and assumptions, shortcuts, you know, cognitive shortcuts, which make our life easier. They're great, right? That's what expertise is all about. You know where to look. You can ignore irrelevant information. And yet when it comes to creativity, you often want to look at irrelevant information. You want the roundabout way. You don't want to know how to attack a problem. You want to be able to think outside the box. And so that's why sometimes knowing less allows us to invent more.
In the book, you talk about some tips on how we can sort of simply improve our own creativity. So perhaps we should look at some of those. For instance, how can we better our local environment to help us be creative or just...
Yeah. You know, the big scale, I think it's important to emphasize that creative is always going to be really, really hard. There is no way to kind of say, here's a PowerPoint slide.
Yeah.
You can be Picasso. Like, if creativity were that easy, Picasso won't be so famous. So it's important to emphasize, like, it's always going to be hard, number one. But I think the crucial skill I wanted to communicate in the book is that there are these different kinds of creative thinking, each of which is well-suited to different kinds of creative problems. So the very first job of someone in the creativity business is to figure out, well, where am I in the process right now? Mm-hmm. How should I be thinking to solve this problem? Do I need a moment of insight? In which case, have a beer. I mean, just last month, the study came out showing that when you get undergrads too drunk to drive, they solve 30% more moment of insight problems. Which, you know, is great news if you're an undergraduate, I guess, and you like your beer. So find a way to relax, take a long hot shower, you know, stop working so hard. But, of course, if you feel like you're making progress, and the technical term for these is feelings of knowing, and I talk about, you know, feelings of knowing extensively in the book about how to use them to diagnose your problem. Mm-hmm. If you're making progress, if you feel like you're getting closer, then keep on working on it. The best advice science can give you is don't give up. Drink coffee, chug a triple espresso, you know, do whatever it is you need to do to stay focused, because eventually that feeling of knowing, the sense that I can get there, I can find the answer, even though I don't know what the answer is, that feeling of knowing will become actual knowledge. So, you know, I think that's the overarching lesson, is we have to do a better job of fine-tuning our thought process to better reflect the kind of problems we're trying to solve. There's this wonderful line of T.S. Eliot's where someone asked him, why are there so many bad poets? And he says, well, the problem with bad poets is they're conscious when they should be unconscious and unconscious when they should be conscious. In a sense, they get their mind backwards. And that's a problem we often make a lot. And I think what we typically do is when we hit the wall, when we're stuck and stumped, we keep on focusing, right? Because that's what our boss says. Don't take a nap. Don't drink a beer in the afternoon. Don't play so much ping pong or foosball. You know, stay in your cubicle. So I think that's the tendency of our society now, is we overemphasize focus. So, you know, I think that's the basic idea, though, is to be able to, if we're just talking about how to adjust our own creativity, it's about being able to better adjust our thought process to the task at hand. Then I think when it comes to the group side, you know, I was very persuaded by some work by Martin Rieff, a sociologist at Princeton, who he looked at the relationship between the innovation levels of entrepreneurs and their social network. And sure enough, those with more diverse social networks are those entrepreneurs who hung out with lots of different people, you know, who hung out with artists and filmmakers and novelists and biologists and so on. They were three times more innovative, and he measured innovation in terms of patents per capita, in terms of patents, trademarks, and revenue from those patents and trademarks. Three times more innovative than those with predictable social networks. And, you know, this speaks to, I think, just the importance of exposing ourselves to all kinds of diversity.
Okay, so just one more thing. On a wider level, you know, all of your books and your writing, your column writing, is basically focused on neuroscience. And I wonder, to what extent do you have to be skeptical of some of the claims and mm-hmm. uses that neuroscience is put to? Because there's a growing neuroscepticism movement.
Yeah.
And it's... You do see neuroscience used to explain a panoply of things.
Sure.
So let's perhaps talk about what you think.
Yeah.
About
it. Look, skepticism is always good. And I've received my fair share of criticism from within the field for being skeptical myself, for writing articles critical of, you know, I think bad fMRI work, bad brain scanning work. I had a long piece in the New Yorker a few years ago on what I call the decline effect, which is the mm-hmm. tendency of many of these results in neuroscience and psychology and clinical trials to fall apart over time, mm-hmm. to not replicate. You can talk about there are various cognitive biases that, you know, scientists are humans. They've got incentives, publication bias, and so on. So I think skepticism is essential. I think what often happens is kind of lazy skepticism, which is that people get in the mind that all fMRI is, you know, bullshit. and then they just tar the bad studies with the good studies. They group them all together. And there are clearly many bad fMRI studies. I still believe the tool can, when used properly, can tell us a lot of interesting things. It's, you know, it's still one of the fundamental tools of cognitive neuroscience, and we've learned a tremendous amount from it as long as one takes into account its limitations. You know, what I tried to do in this book is not just use fMRI, not just EEG. I think there are only three fMRI studies in the book and one EEG study, but really try to bring a series of diverse strands of evidence to bear on the subject. So talk about neurological patients, you can talk about various kinds of brain disease, you can talk about, you know, brain development, you can talk about what happens when you fall asleep. You can all sorts of different streams of evidence to bear on a single theme. Because I think that's the way neuroscience should be done. No tool is definitive. Our tools mm-hmm. are still too crude. But if you take many different snapshots of the same problem, of the same activity, I think you can begin to get an interesting picture of what's actually happening. Still just a very first glimpse, a very rough draft that is sure to be revised. You know, just in terms of this, I think this larger pushback, and this was summarized, I think, it was in a Guardian review, which was very, very critical of the book, where the reviewer argued that, in a sense, this neuroscience was useless, right? Because it told us stuff we already know, that, you know, people have been, when they're stumped, they've been relaxing for a long time. Archimedes took a bath. Bob Dylan went to Woodstock. This isn't exactly, you know, earth-shattering stuff. We've also known we need to edit our ideas, too. That's a totally fair point. My first book, after all, is about Proofs of the Neuroscientist, all about how these intuitions we have about how our mind works are often profoundly wise and very, very prophetic. But I think that's not enough. We should be clear that there is a reason we had the Enlightenment, that what's that great Ben Goldacre quote about the plural of anecdotes is not data? That these anecdotes are not enough, and it's still useful, I think still important, to have the science to come along and help explain these anecdotes. Because people have had all sorts of intuitions about creativity and about the human mind and human nature. Many of them have been true. Many of them have been wise and interesting. And many of them have been completely wrong. So I think at the very least we need neuroscience to help us clarify these intuitions. So I do push back against this strong form of neuroskepticism or, you know, this ridicule of neuroscientism or whatever they want to call it. Simply because I do think neuroscience, it's yet another way of knowing ourselves. And this is an ancient quest to understand human nature, and neuroscience is the latest way. It's very important to be clear. It doesn't displace any other way of knowing ourselves. You know, I always get very, very antsy when I hear neuroscientists use the phrase nothing but. Mm-hmm. That looking at a Rembrandt self-portrait is nothing but oscillations of electricity in the V4 part of the visual cortex, or creativity is nothing but the anterior superior temporal gyrus. That kind of crude reductionism, or, you know, my favorite is, God is nothing but a mini seizure in the temporal lobes. I mean, that's ridiculous. Of course it's not nothing but, you know, that is just crass and crude reductionism. But as long as you see this as just another layer of description, another way of understanding ourselves, that there are still aspects of that Rembrandt self-portrait that you can summarize in terms of the brain. And, you know, and the brain is in many respects sometimes the least interesting way to understand these questions. But I think sometimes it's an interesting way. It's a valid way. It's a valid way of trying to address these deep mysteries. So that's kind of my view on where the field is. I mean, it is a very, very young field. Right now, we know enough to just realize how little we understand. And I think as long as one makes that clear, as long as one points out that this is still a very mysterious 3 pounds of meat, it strikes me as it's an interesting field to write about, it's an interesting field to support, that it's just another way of knowing ourselves.
That's a perfect place for us to end. So I've been talking to Joe Nalira about his book Imagine, How Creativity Works, which is out now from Canongate. Jonah, thank you so much for talking to Little Atoms again today. It's been brilliant.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.